You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you want to keep food cold, you throw it in your refrigerator. But in the late 1800s, you'd be using an ice box. We'll find out why those were good times for Wisconsin's ice harvesting industry with a Wisconsin historian. First, if you've ever taken a trip to the emergency room or heard the stories from someone else who has, it's never a fun time, even when things go smoothly. You might worry about long wait times, too, with little FaceTime with an actual doctor or nurse. But what's it like on the other side of things, for the physicians who work in the emergency room and see an endless line of patients with a wide variety of health problems? Dr. Gina Siddiqui is a resident physician in the emergency room at Yale New Haven Hospital. She writes about how modern medicine has been both a success and a failure for publications like Scientific American and Quartz. She wrote the piece, A Doctor's Diary, The Overnight Shift in the ER, for the New York Times. Dr. Siddiqui, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
What led you to want to practice in an emergency room?
I think what I really liked about my first few shifts in the ER was this constant drive to connect with people instantly. There's no beating around the bush. You really don't get second chances. And it doesn't matter what the person looks like, you know, where they're from. You have to figure out a way to get them to instantly trust you and, you know, you guys get on the same team to figure out what's going on with them. You know, sometimes it's something that they're embarrassed about, like something that happened in the bedroom. Sometimes it's something that could get them in the trouble with the law. Sometimes they're just really mad because they've been in the waiting room for a long time. And, you know, my job is to, no matter what the reason is for them being there, to figure out a way to help them and make them better off when they leave. And I just thought that was so in line with what I went to med school to do.
In your doctor's diary, you give a sense of the kinds of cases you might encounter in just one night. Can you, for people who haven't worked in an emergency room, can you give a sense of the scope, the range of things that you might see in a given night?
Yeah, absolutely. The nighttime is sort of singular in how much of a grab bag it is because we're really the only game in town. But emergency rooms see really fascinating patterns throughout the year. Pretty much any ER in America, if you ask them the busiest day of the week, it's a Monday. And if you ask them the least busy day, pretty much everyone will say the Super Bowl during the game. At dawn, there's a weird spike in heart attacks and strokes. Then there's seasonal variations, you know, summer, especially hot summer nights. There's a lot of trauma, a lot of fights, stabbings, gunshot wounds. Rainy days, more people will come in depressed. And in bad weather, you see more car accidents, things like that. So it's a really weird way that you're connected with what's going on outside in your neighborhood. Similarly, if there's, you know, like a pain management doctor who leaves for another town or a specialist who whose practice closes, you suddenly might see a spike in people who have that need and, you know, can't find an office appointment for it anymore.
You write that a lot of the cases you might see, especially at night, are not what we might think of as emergencies, but they're people who are there because, like you said, it's the only game in town. Their urgent care clinic, their general practitioner, if they have one, we'll get into that. They're not open. Are we using emergency rooms for a lot of non-emergencies?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. I think the first thing to just put out there up front is that we can't always tell what's an emergency from the beginning, you know. You can sort of audit or review cases afterwards, and it's sometimes seems like, oh, you know, why did this person who ended up having the flu get this, you know, really involved workup? But if they came in, you know, with a really fast heart rate, a very high fever, and feeling very unwell, we have to rule out a lot of dangerous things before we say that, you know, chalk it up just to the flu. There's a large group of patients that I think it would be sort of premature or unfair to say that they're inappropriately using the ER just because, thank goodness, by the time they go home, we realize they aren't having an emergency. You know, every person who comes in with chest pain who doesn't end up having a heart attack, we wouldn't say that they were inappropriately using the ER.
We're talking to Dr. Gina Siddiqui from Yale New Haven Hospital. She's a resident physician in the emergency room there. In the piece you wrote, Dr. Siddiqui, there is a problem you see out there, and I assume all emergency rooms see this, people who end up in the emergency room again and again, and in large part you write it's because nobody deals with the fundamental causes, the day-to-day causes that end up driving them back into the emergency room. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the reasons that more and more people are coming to the ER and some of them are revisiting again and again are kind of related to how medicine has evolved. In a way, we're victims of our own success. You know, there are diseases that people used to not be able to survive with. And now, you know, they're making it out of the hospital. They're living for years and years longer than would be expected in the past. But they're very fragile, and they're sort of always teetering on this edge that even a small problem could be life-threatening for them. So they're told, you know, to come to the ER with any problem. So patients with mechanical hearts, patients who are on transplant lists, other people who are immunosuppressed, all the people in America on dialysis, they're coming to the ER very often. Similarly, our population is aging, and a lot of elderly people have a little bit of heart failure, a little bit of kidney disease, a little bit of COPD, and they come to the ER a lot too. Then, you know, as a society, we're changing. People don't live in the same town that they grew up in, that their parents grew up in, so they don't have a family doctor who knows them very well. They might have a job that doesn't really allow them to leave for an afternoon or a whole morning like people used to for doctor's appointments. They need something quick and on demand. And then the family doctor, they're strained in a different way than they used to be. They can't pencil people in for appointments like they used to. Doctors used to see kidney stones for patients themselves. It's very rare now for a doctor to be able to put their day aside for someone who has a sudden emergency like that. Because medicine has gotten so complex and so specialized, we know so much about the kidneys, the heart, the lungs. People have specialists. And with every increasing specialist that you have comes an added layer of complexity of who you're going to see for an appointment. I've seen many people in the ER who say, you know, this isn't urgent. This didn't just happen today. Actually happened several weeks ago. But I was told I'd have to wait months to see a neurologist. So that's why I'm here.
You also talk in your piece about a program at Yale, and there are similar pilot programs elsewhere, trying to work with people who have chronic conditions and work with them at home. I think the Yale program was about helping prevent falls among some of the older patients who are admitted to the ER. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. The PRIDE program at Yale basically found elderly patients who came to the ER after they fell and said, you know, first, of course, in the ER, we'll make sure you didn't break your hip and are safe to go home. But after that, let's think about what circumstance led to you falling and see if we can prevent it from happening again. After the patient was sent home, they had a follow-up visit by a medic, a paramedic, and also a nurse. And basically, they went through a pretty simple checklist of common things that in an elderly person's home, medicine cabinet, medical plan can lead to problems. And by systematically going through that list for these patients, they did a tremendous job of preventing future problems compared against those same patients who didn't have that follow-up. And I think one of the most fascinating things about this group that I didn't talk about in the article is they offered the same service, these home visits to assess for fall risks, to all elderly people in the community. The volunteer families that they went and did home visits for, those fall risk assessments did not prevent future ER visits. They did not decrease their risk. I think what this shows is that patients who come to the ER are declaring themselves as high-risk people. They're declaring themselves as people, if we give them extra resources, if we try to be more preventative and proactive with them, actually we're going to really see the benefit of that time and money that we invest in them.
Do you see that as a wider movement to take these high-risk patients who present themselves in the ER and reach out and help them keep themselves out of the ER by these kind of interventions?
I think it's certainly an interesting question. Sometimes people will come in the middle of the night asking for an STD check or a pregnancy test. And obviously, you know, you can get a pregnancy test at a drugstore and you can get an STD checked not in an emergency room, you know, like in a less urgent setting. But if we step back and ask ourselves, you know, how high risk are these people? If, you know, people have tracked them for a year out after that initial ER visit, how many of them come back with an unwanted pregnancy or with complications of STDs that have, you know, very costly downstream consequences? So I think if we reframed it as, is the immediate problem that they're asking about an emergency versus, are these people in a high-risk situation and do they really not have other places within the health system where we can reach them and offer them some of these preventative resources? It's kind of a different use of the ER.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Siddiqui, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks again so much for having me.
That was Dr. Gina Siddiqui, a resident physician in the emergency room at Yale New Haven Hospital. She wrote the piece, A Doctor's Diary, The Overnight Shift in the ER, for the New York Times. Coming up, we'll talk to a local historian about Wisconsin's past as a leader in ice harvesting and how that shaped the state's role in other industries like beer brewing and meatpacking. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democratic presidential candidates faced off last night in the last debate before the Iowa caucuses. We'll break down what happened in our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. First, temperatures are dropping for much of Wisconsin, and that means that many of the state's lakes will start to freeze over if they haven't already. But if we traveled back in time to the late 19th century, this would be prime time for a big Wisconsin industry that's fallen by the wayside, ice harvesting. WPR host Keely Baltina talked to Madison historian Ann Weidlich about why the state was a leader in ice harvesting and how that impacted our place in industries like beer brewing and meatpacking.
As we're getting started with this ice harvesting conversation, I can't help but think of the movie Frozen. It opens with these images of people with big saws,
yes,
you know, sawing through these huge chunks of ice and throwing them on sleds. Is that ice harvesting?
Yes, it is. It's a quite realistic portrayal of ice harvesting. The fun part about the sawing of the ice is that the saw is different from an ordinary wood saw. It has a handle that comes up at an angle. And so if you see a funny saw in an antique store that's not like an ordinary wood saw, it probably is an ice saw.
So we see these mostly men outside doing really difficult work in the cold, getting these big blocks of ice. Why was ice harvesting so important?
Well, people wanted ice. They had ice boxes starting in the mid-1800s. And they needed ice to keep food cold in these ice boxes. But also, the growth of the ice industry was because of meat packing and also beer brewing. People in Wisconsin and in the United States liked a lighter beer called lager beer. And in order to brew and store lager beer, it needed to be at a cold temperature. So there wasn't what I call mechanical refrigeration available early on, and so they would use ice to keep the beer cold, both during brewing and during storage. But then also the meatpacking industry, because it used to be that you either had to smoke the meat or salt the meat or turn it into sausages in order to keep it, particularly through the summertime. And when they discovered that you could cool down the meat, and if you kept it cold, it would last longer. Then they went out and harvested all the ice they could find. And eventually the big meat packers got into making ice in mechanically rather than cutting it out of the ice ponds.
The industries you're pointing to are big Wisconsin industries from,
yes,
beer making. We even think of, you know, Oscar Mayer's presence,
yes,
here.
Yes, and Oscar Mayer started out cutting ice out of Lake Mendota, but early on realized that it was not going to be enough and it was an awful lot of hard work. And so they made very fine, very clear, very pure ice, and then they allowed their workers to take some of that ice home. And then the workers told their neighbors, and their neighbors wanted some of that ice too. So actually, Oscar Mayer also got into the ice delivery business up until after World War II. And then almost everyone had a mechanical refrigerator and could make their own ice and didn't need ice delivery. But yeah, Oscar Mayer was into ice as much as meat.
And that industry developed secondary to the ice harvesting, right? The ice was necessary for those to thrive here.
Yes. Yes, and as I say, people wanted ice for ice boxes came in the mid-1800s, and their quality varied about depending on how much money you wanted to spend on an ice box, but they weren't really that cold, and it wasn't really that satisfactory, and so people switched over to mechanical refrigerators as soon as they became available in the late 1920s.
What was the role of the railroad here in Wisconsin to take Wisconsin ice all over the place?
Yes, we were very fortunate in Wisconsin. We not only had nice cold winters that produced nice hard ice, but we also had a lot of railroads coming into the state at first because of the lumbering in the northern part of the state. But then it was obvious that ice could be shipped in boxcars to the southern states. They would really like some of our nice hard cold ice. And so with the North Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul and Pacific Railroad and the Illinois Central Railroad, both of them shipped Illinois Central more down towards St. Louis, and the Northwestern Railroad down to Chicago.
How did they keep it cold once it got to warmer climates, or how did they ship ice in the summertime?
Well, they had developed refrigerated boxcars that would store the ice fairly well. And then there were also big ice houses down in Chicago and St. Louis and elsewhere where, again, they would store the ice. And they were insulated, of course, with either straw or sawdust often. And later on, as things like styrofoam came into existence, they would be insulated with materials such as that. And they did lose ice. I mean, it did melt. They couldn't keep it totally hard. But these ice houses were constructed in such a way that the water from the ice melting was taken away and the air was circulated to try and preserve as much of the ice as possible.
Ann Weidlich is a former reference librarian at the Madison Public Library who's now a local historian here in Madison. And we are talking about ice harvesting, which was a really prominent industry here in Wisconsin, 100, 150 years ago. And let's go back to that ice harvesting. What did that work look like? Can you paint a picture for us?
Well, first of all, they had to scrape the ice clear of any snow that had accumulated on the ice. And then they would go out with what was called snow plows, or excuse me, ice plows. And these were rows of teeth on what looked like a saw drawn by horses that would cut a groove into the ice in about 20-inch sections. And then they would go the other way to cut another 20-inch section going the other way. Then they would use these ice saws that we talked about to actually literally saw through these grooves. And then they would use ice picks to push these blocks of ice into channels that led up to the ice house at the edge of the lake. And there would be a conveyor belt that would drag these ice blocks up into the ice house. And there would be men up there who would push the ice blocks around in the ice house to get them stacked upright, and then also adding the straw or sawdust to prevent the ice blocks from freezing together, but also to insulate the whole section in general. And so it was a lot of very hard, very cold, often wet. People used to come to watch the men do the ice harvesting because very often a horse or a man would fall in the water. And that was a lot of excitement to drag the horse or the person out of the water. Was a thrill that you could go to the edge and watch and see if that would happen.
And it sounds like very cold work. It sounds like the men who did this work also had a taste for whiskey.
Yes, it's often said that an alcoholic beverage of some sort would help them stay warm while they were doing this very heavy, wet, cold work.
And very dangerous work at the
yes.
same time. Very sharp things, very heavy things. Who were the people who did the work?
Well, in Wisconsin, we had a lot of farms in the summertime, and they would hire single men mostly to do farm work in the summer. And then these men were, quote, free, so to speak, in the wintertime to take up this kind of employment. It would last for 2, 3, 4 weeks, probably at the end of January, sometime in February. It was temporary work. They might get as much as $1, $1.50 a day to do this work. But this is going back to the late 1800s.
And where in Wisconsin were the best places to harvest ice?
It would have been lakes, where, and especially a deeper lake, so that the water was still and didn't get a lot of bubbles into it, which would happen if the water was flowing. We had a lot of mill ponds throughout the state because the mill was used in the summer or winter for, well, mostly the summer, for grinding wheat and flour and sawing lumber. So these mill ponds were pretty good. And so almost every little town in Wisconsin had some effort to cut ice out of the mill ponds and store it for their own local use, and maybe a little bit of delivery to the nearby farms. But it was Milwaukee and Madison that had the biggest ice harvesting companies and would do the most in terms of delivering it elsewhere.
Now we have refrigerators and freezers that run off of electricity. Does ice harvesting still happen today?
Yes, a little bit. Several historical societies throughout the state will off and on do ice harvesting demonstrations with the equipment that they've collected in their museums. And then I understand that the Amish are still active in cutting ice because they don't rely on electricity and have to build ice houses to store ice so that they too can enjoy ice in the summertime.
Anne, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
You're very welcome.
That was WPR host Keely Boltina talking to local Madison historian Anne Weidlich about the state's ice harvesting history. If you want to find out more about it or see some of the old pictures of ice harvesters at work, you can find the article at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, the U.S. Senate is gearing up for an impeachment trial next week. We'll talk about what we can expect coming up next. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll look at what happened last night at President Trump's rally in Milwaukee and find out how the GOP and Democrats are talking to Wisconsin voters ahead of 2020. First, we take a look at some of the other big political stories this week. There are lots of them. The articles of impeachment will soon be on their way to the U.S. Senate, setting up a trial of the president, likely next week. Newly released documents shed more light on the president's actions and those of his attorney in Ukraine. And Democratic candidates for president debated in Iowa less than a month before the first primary contest. Our question for you this week, what are you paying attention to in the Democratic primary race? If you plan to vote for a Democrat, do you have your mind made up? Are you still watching certain issues to decide? Or does it just matter who ends up running in November? You'll vote for them no matter who they are. If you're a Republican or independent, what are your thoughts on the field of candidates? Are you paying attention yet or trying to avoid election fatigue 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
We'll tackle that debate in just a bit. But today, the House taking its final formal steps to finally send the two articles of impeachment against the president to the Senate. I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing that move this morning.
Today, on the floor, we'll pass a resolution naming the managers, as I mentioned, appropriating the funds for the trial and transmitting the articles of impeachment of the president of the United States for trying to influence a foreign government for his own personal and political benefit.
Pelosi had held on to these articles for almost a month, is now ready to send them over. Can you shed some light, Ginger, on the timing? Why now?
Yeah, it's a great question. Pelosi has said she did it in order to bring more public attention to the need to have witnesses during the Senate trial, that she was trying to make sure the public was aware of what the process was going to be. Others have speculated that she was trying to get the process out of the Christmas lull when the public pays less attention, or at least have some ability to negotiate with the Senate about how they were going to proceed and whether they would have witnesses. I suspect in the grand scheme of things, this delay will matter very little. Voters aren't going to be looking, 10 months from now during the election and say, well, why did Nancy Pelosi wait 3 weeks? It's just a little bit of procedure intrigue inside the Beltway, I suspect.
When is the Senate expected to actually sit down and start tackling this stuff, assuming everything goes as planned, it gets walked over today?
Yeah, I just got an email from Senator Mitch McConnell's office explaining that they will begin tomorrow to formally review these articles of impeachment. We understand that the House managers had planned to walk them over. McConnell's office is saying that once they are notified, they have to set the time in order to read them, and that time is going to be set on Thursday. So the formal process will kick off, it seems, Thursday when that reading takes place.
Some new news coming out now that some House Democrats are saying should add fuel to the fire in the Senate. We have Lev Parnas, an associate of the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Parnas facing campaign finance charges. Now, a judge allowed him to turn over documents to the House Intelligence Committee related to his work in Ukraine. That's getting a lot of buzz over the last day or so. What kind of things are we seeing there?
We're seeing more concerns coming from House Democrats, particularly about these documents. They have released these messages that were exchanged between Rudy Giuliani's associates, people who were close to him and who were working, we understand, behind the scenes to try to pressure the Ukrainians to investigate President Trump's political rivals. There's now concern that these messages reveal that former Ambassador Maria Yovanovitch might have been in danger at some point, that there were threats being made against her. However, the individual who was making those threats now claims he was drunk. I think he was suggesting that it was a joke. But this is quickly not becoming a joking matter, and we see more discussion about what was going on behind the scenes by Trump's allies when this was all unfolding.
This is newer information now, just got to the House Democrats over the last week or so. Do we have any indication from the Senate as to whether they're going to end up looking at new information, whether how they're going to resolve this question of do they take more witnesses or not?
It remains to be undetermined whether or not they would take witnesses, either new folks like John Bolton, who we haven't heard from in this process, or any of the witnesses that testified during the House proceedings. There's a real political risk on both sides of this, whether or not they take witnesses. You know, McConnell wants this to be dispatched with quickly. He doesn't want a lot of fanfare. He doesn't want the Senate to be made into a circus. But he also knows, and he's hearing from his members who are up for re-election this year, that there's a risk if they move too quickly, if they don't give this something of an actual hearing and actually consider some of the evidence, that voters will punish those members for feeling like they just moved through the process and didn't actually weigh any of the evidence.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from Reuters, looking at some of the top stories in the week in national politics. We'll be turning to the Democratic debates in just a moment. You can join with your thoughts on the ongoing Democratic primary at 800-642-1234. Ginger, let's turn to that debate now. What stood out to you of this now smaller field of Democrats who reached the standards to show up on stage last night?
That's right. We had six Democrats on stage last night. We've come a long way from the summer when they had 20 Democrats split over two nights. And that meant that we got to hear a little bit more from each of the candidates. They had longer time to speak. They were able to have longer discussions on single topics. But it wasn't particularly explosive. There was quite a bit of good-natured back and forth. There was some disagreements on Iran, on past Iraq war votes, on how the United States should move forward on trade. And then, of course, there was the moment between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, in which Bernie Sanders was asked about reports that he had told Elizabeth Warren in a 2018 meeting that he did not believe a woman could beat Donald Trump.
Let's give a listen to Elizabeth Warren also responding to a similar question about that that alleged statement. Here's Senator Warren.
This question about whether or not a woman can be president has been raised, and it's time for us to attack it head on. And I think the best way to talk about who can win is by looking at people's winning record. So can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women, Amy and me.
What do you make of how Elizabeth Warren handled that issue?
You know, she's been given a lot of praise last night and today for how she responded, that the answer was clearly making the case that a woman can get elected, that it was sort of jokingly disparaging the men on the stage. And it was sort of handling this controversy quickly and moving on and sort of not dwelling on it, turning it into a bigger picture, making it more Trump-focused. I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said about what all of these little flashpoints in an election can mean for the election. And what Bernie Sanders said 2 years ago, probably not going to have a huge impact on the election, but how he handles this, how Elizabeth Warren handles this now, the tone of their responses could have some impact. Those are the things that voters are watching. And so a lot of praise for her today that she handled that well, and that she appeared to put forward a strong case for women while not getting sort of bogged down in the controversy.
You mentioned that foreign policy, Iran and the Middle East came up. Let's give a listen to former Vice President Joe Biden.
We have lost our standing in the region. We have lost the support of our allies. The next president has to be able to pull those folks back together, reestablish our alliances, and insist that Iran go back into the agreement.
What other kinds of things did we hear from the field on the Iran issue?
Yeah, we saw the candidates weighing in on Iran. They were quite critical of the way President Trump is handling Iran, the way he's handled the decision to kill General Soleimani, and how he's handled general relationships with Iran. Many of the people on stage supported the Iran nuclear deal. We saw Amy Klobuchar talking about how she had worked on it while as a senator in the role that the Senate was advising, and that they thought that that deal should be restored, that the way to move forward was diplomatic relations and not military. And we saw Bernie Sanders and, you know, and Joe Biden having this back and forth about their Iraq war vote. And Bernie Sanders arguing, as someone who opposed the Iraq war, he would be able to sort of negotiate to approach this issue through diplomatic tactics and not through more military action.
Healthcare is still a big issue, and it's been a big issue for Democrats in the primary. What came out last night? Anything new from the candidates on the stage?
We have heard these candidates talking about healthcare from day one, and we know that voters view this as one of their top issues, so they're not going to stop talking about it. But we did hear much of the same debate that we had already heard, candidates arguing in favor of either big, sweeping, systemic, overarching changes of the U.S. healthcare system, getting rid of insurance entirely, having a whole new government-run system. That was the argument being made by folks like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And then we saw Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar arguing for a more measured approach, taking the system that we have now, building upon Obamacare. There was a back and forth between Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg over whether their plans were the right approach. And Elizabeth Warren saying that Pete Buttigieg just didn't want to spend enough money, that he wasn't being too cheap to cover everyone. And Buttigieg arguing that Washington is wrong to measure plans and proposals by how much they cost, and that there are ways to approach the U.S. health system to improve it without taking on the kind of spending that Elizabeth Warren wants to.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters, looking at the week in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1071. one, two, three, four. Did you watch the Democratic primary debate last night? What stood out to you? What issue, what statement, which candidate? Do you plan on voting for one of them if they're still in the running by the time it comes to Wisconsin? What are you watching for in Iowa? For our Iowa listeners, what are you looking forward to with this caucus? Do you have a candidate in mind? If you're watching this from outside the Democratic Party, if you're an independent or a Republican, what do you make of the candidates and what they have to say? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters, about some of the week's top stories in national politics. Let's bring in a caller on one of the issues we've talked about so far. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. With the information that's been coming out more recently, I think it further shows how Trump is guilty. And if you look back at that phone call with the Ukrainian president, just count up the number of times he brought up Giuliani's name and consider that Giuliani was basically trying to be there to push an unethical act. And what came out really reinforces that. The Republicans claimed back in the House they wanted more witnesses. I took a look at the witnesses they wanted. For some strange reason, Giuliani and Mulvaney never showed up on that list, but I think they really would take away the argument, if they did, that Democrats were just assuming things because they would be able to say what they were doing.
Nate, thanks for the call. And that's something Democrats are bringing up. They want some names out there to connect some of the dots from the president to Rudy Giuliani to the people he was working with in Ukraine.
That's right. We know that the Democrats have argued that these folks should still testify, that there are still things that they could clarify for the American public, that there are questions that they could answer. We also heard President Trump early in this process argue that once the impeachment got into the Senate, once there was a Senate trial, that it was his turf, that his allies would be running the show, and that it would be a time for his witnesses to come forward and redeem him, to prove that the Democrats were wrong. The president appears to have abandoned that position, and it was a position we know that Mitch McConnell thought was not wise. So the president tweeted over the weekend that instead he thought that the Senate should just dismiss the whole thing and not even hold a trial. We know that the Senate is unlikely to do that. But there was talk at one point that these witnesses, someone like Mick Mulvaney, could be called to testify essentially in the president's favor and as something that the president thought would be a net positive for him.
Thanks a lot for that call. We've got a caller with a question about the Iowa caucuses now, I think. Frank is with us in La Crosse. Frank, hi.
Yeah, I was curious. How does the Democratic caucus work if a Trump supporter shows up and wants to speak? Are they allowed to? Are they asked to leave? What happens in that situation?
Frank, thanks for the call. My understanding, Ginger, is you in the Iowa caucuses can vote in a caucus for the party in which you are registered. So it's not so easy to cross parties to vote on the other side.
That's right. You have to be registered. They have a closed caucus in Iowa, so Republicans and independents can't show up and participate. Now, that's not to say there aren't Trump voters who are registered as Democrats in Iowa, and they could show up. But I haven't been in a number of caucuses. I can tell you they're a little more organized than just anyone being able to get up and speak. The precinct captains are organizing speakers. There's a speaker at the beginning and then a speaker in the middle. And it's not sort of the free-for-all that I think some people think the Iowa caucuses are. So if someone started shouting in favor of President Trump, I think they would probably be asked to leave or made to leave very quickly.
Frank, thanks for that call. And Frank brings us to now the next big event. The official debates are done for now, and some kind of voting is coming up. What are people watching for now, Ginger, in Iowa?
I think in Iowa, they're going to be watching very closely to see who the top three or four candidates are. As the cliche goes, there are three tickets out of Iowa, maybe four this time, depending on how closely grouped together they are. If you want to sound smart next time we're talking about Iowa and the caucuses, point out the fact that there's a 15% threshold that candidates have to meet in order to be considered viable and to get delegates. So someone like Amy Klobuchar, who's polling around 8%, could come in fifth place and get no delegates. Also, after the first vote at these caucuses are taken, if a candidate doesn't have 15% in that caucus, their supporters then have to realign or pick another candidate. And that could mean someone like Klobuchar could have a lot of influence based on where her voters go and who they pick as a second choice.
Iowa is important, but it doesn't. The winner of Iowa doesn't necessarily go on to win the overall campaign, it looks like. Do I have that right?
That's right. We saw last cycle Hillary Clinton barely beat out Bernie Sanders. She did win that win. Barack Obama won the Iowa caucuses in 2008. He won that nomination. So it happens a little more often on the Democratic side that the winner of Iowa goes on to win the entire nomination. Less so on the Republican side. Ted Cruz won the Iowa caucuses in 2016. But it should be clear that whoever does win Iowa isn't a sure bet. There's going to be quite a bit more contest after that. New Hampshire will be an important test. South Carolina and Nevada, and then on to Super Tuesday. So there's a lot between Iowa and the convention that the ultimate nominee is going to have to prevail on.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters, looking at some of the top news in national politics. Turning to non-impeachment news in Congress, Ginger, President Trump's decision to kill Iranian military commander Soleimani got some pushback from members of Congress who weren't part of that decision. Now we have this Democratic-led resolution to limit the president's war powers coming up in the Senate. What are we looking at here?
We are looking at a vote in the Senate, likely, that would try to limit how much action President Trump could take in the region without war powers authorization by Congress. If you remember, back to high school civics, the power to declare war is invested in Congress. President Trump has contended that the existing authorizations dealing with terrorism in the Middle East are all the approval he's needed from Congress in order to act, particularly since that action he was taking was in Iraq. Members of Congress have become less comfortable with this in recent years. There was a War Powers Act that was passed by Congress under President Obama that limited some of the actions that could be taken in the region. And now we see a growing bipartisan support to limit what President Trump could do. Now, let's be clear, we don't yet see enough support between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and or the House to override a veto, which we would expect from President Trump. But we are likely to see this vote. We are likely to see, now they're talking about four, maybe five Republicans crossing over and voting with Democrats on a resolution that Senator Kaine has authored that would limit the president's powers.
Are people talking about this even if it passes but gets vetoed? Are supporters saying this would at least be a symbolic message to President Trump and maybe even future presidents about their war authority?
Absolutely. So the previous legislation that was passed and a veto overridden, presidents have contended that it was unconstitutional. It still remains in place. They haven't actually managed to sort of get thrown out. And they'll continue to make this argument about future resolutions, but it does send a message and it does let the country know, particularly people that are opposed to an escalating war, that Congress is paying attention, that they are voicing some concern. And it is symbolic in many ways. Presidents need public opinion to go to war. It's very difficult to launch a war without the support of your country. And it does send a message to the administration that they have not made a convincing enough case at this point to gain that public support.
Well, lots of big news this week. Ginger, briefly as we wrap up, what is your eye on in the next week to come?
And the next week is going to be impeachment, impeachment, impeachment. The trial is going to kick off in the Senate. It's really going to be rolling. We're going to have the House managers presenting their argument. President Trump likely to have his aides, his lawyers out defending him. And the overlap with the election, there are three senators who are running for president that will be there participating, Senator Warren, Senator Klobuchar, Senator Sanders, and what roles they play and how they continue to try to campaign in Iowa while stuck in Washington.
Ginger, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. She joined us for a weekly look at some of the latest news in national politics. Well, that's not all the news. President Trump also held a rally in Milwaukee last night. In just a bit, we'll talk to a reporter who was in the building about what the president had to say and to look at some of the key factors to winning the next election in Wisconsin. And there's a good chance that whoever wins here in Wisconsin is going to win the whole shebang. We'll find out why coming up. Christmas cookie season is over. We've hopefully finished up our leftovers at this point, but there's a lot more crunchy, sugary goodness around the corner with Girl Scout cookie season, just a couple weeks away, depending on where you are. Here's something weird that I just learned from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Depending on where in Wisconsin you get your Girl Scout cookies, they may taste different. Turns out there are two different bakeries with a national license to make these Girl Scout cookies. Each troop contracts with one of the two bakeries. Almost all of Wisconsin uses one of those bakeries, but one troop based in Sheboygan uses the other one. And there are some noticeable differences even in their own descriptions of the cookies. So in the Sheboygan area, if you get Thin Mints, they are crisp, chocolatey cookies made with natural oil of peppermint. Rest of Wisconsin Thin Mints, crisp chocolate wafers dipped in a mint fudge coating. Okay, then Sheboygan area peanut butter patties, crispy cookies layered with peanut butter and covered with a chocolatey coating. Rest of Wisconsin peanut butter patties, crispy cookies layered with peanut butter and covered with a fudge coating. Even the names are different, with Do-Si-Do's in Sheboygan taking over for the peanut butter sandwich in the rest of the state. In the interest of hard-hitting journalism, I volunteer for a WPR fact-finding expedition to compare and contrast the two different bakeries. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.